For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. For the past few weeks in the run-up to the federal election, we've been talking about different ways to fix various sectors of the Australian healthcare system. This week, it's the turn of our complicated private health sector.
It's not all doctors, and it's not all doctors all the time, but there are a small number of doctors and a small number of services that consistently attract out-of-pocket costs that are above what the average family can afford to pay.
That was Dr. Rachel David, CEO of Private Healthcare Australia, the peak representative body of private health insurance in this country. Dr. David shares with us what she believes are the biggest problems and some possible solutions to improve not only patient outcomes, but costs and efficiencies. Dr. David is my special guest today. What do you see as the big issues in private health in Australia at the moment? Where do the problems lie?
There are three that I can identify straight up. And the first one is fairly obviously with rising cost of living and inflation on the horizon, affordability. We represent 14 million Australians, and the private health market is simply limited by what they can pay. And whether that comes out of the premium or is an out-of-pocket cost, there's going to be more and more pressure on that as we see interest rates rise and things like housing affordability begin to bite families.
Do you see any hope in the election campaign so far for what might happen?
Well, look, the election campaign has not focused on health to anywhere near the extent that I believe is appropriate. We have a lot of issues, particularly after the pandemic. Basically, the defunding of general practice over many, many years and the diminution of primary care is a huge issue even for private health insurance. GPs are the gateway to the system, and if they're not well supported, then this can lead to a lot of consequences, including lack of access to the system and low value care. And we're also seeing huge pressure on workforces in hospitals, which if that's not addressed in an appropriate way, could lead to inflation and lack of access throughout the system. Yeah. So we would have liked to see more attention on the health system from all the parties and the independents, but hopefully once the result is known and the extent of the challenges which are facing the system are realised, then their work can start.
So affordability is one problem. What's another?
The second is really the over-regulation of the sector. The sector, private health is in its current form, was created as part of the Medicare program by the Hawke and Keating government and bolted in to Medicare through the Medicare benefit schedule. Since that time, there have been multiple changes to the system which have kind of put band-aids on it over the years, and rather than removing regulation and looking at these problems from scratch as they come up, people have tended to put band-aid solutions in place. So now we have almost a spaghetti bowl of regulation, a lot of which has the effect of pushing health funds into a passive payer role, where they simply end up writing checks to various providers without any ability to stop wasteful use of members' funds or over-servicing, for example. The other effect is often we have contradictory obligations put on the health funds by different regulators. This has the effect of tying up health funds in costly and time-consuming exercises where, you know, the effort would be better directed towards supporting their members.
So when you talk about deregulating, will that improve affordability?
That is the goal of deregulation. So both in reducing membership expenses, but also allowing the funds a more efficient pathway towards controlling costs that are clearly wasteful. And one of the main areas that we at PHA have campaigned on over the last 5 to 6 years has been the ridiculous level of overpricing of generic medical technology, which is completely regulated by the Commonwealth government. So whatever the Commonwealth says the benefit is, we need to pay that.
Is there an example of that that you can give us?
Oh, yeah. We've had some of the generic products, and their overpricing is astonishing. So we identified a simple titanium bolt, which is not implanted in the body but is used in external fixation. Price was over $1,000 on the Commonwealth regulated price. And, you know, we could buy the same thing on international markets for about $42. We've also some of the hemostatic sponges that are used in surgery now. We went out to compare prices and we were able to buy a packet of five on the Amazon retail site for a fifth of the price. It is regulated under the prosthesis list.
So who's making the money there?
Well, about two-thirds of the excess profits just go straight to Wall Street for the big medical technology firms, which are mostly based in the US. And about one-third of the funding, for a long time we didn't really understand how it worked, but about one-third of the excess funding is actually going to the big for-profit hospital groups, because as they've globalized, what they're able to do is procure generic medical technology on the global market for a much reduced cost. But of course, in Australia, we need to pay them the Commonwealth regulated benefit so they get to keep the difference. Now, we think more transparency is needed on that. There is just no reason why health fund members, the 14 million people that, you know, I've talked about earlier, should be paying this without getting something for it in return. So we've lobbied very hard for the Commonwealth to reduce these inflated benefits back in line with public hospital prices and prices paid in comparable economies around the world. And that will enable us not only to pay doctors and hospitals, which need to attract more nurses and so forth, better, but it will enable us to adequately fund more innovative products in future.
So affordability, regulation, what's the other one?
The third one is out-of-pocket costs, particularly out-of-pockets that are not known by consumers and out-of-pockets that increase very steeply for reasons that aren't clear. Most of this is generated by doctors. For the most part, our hospital contracts cover the costs of care. It's not all doctors and it's not all doctors all the time, but there are a small number of doctors and a small number of services that consistently attract out-of-pocket costs that are above what the average family can afford to pay. And I think that, you know, the reasons for this are complex. Sometimes, in some cases, it is just income raising and a money-making exercise by the provider concerned. But there are other underlying issues like the NBS. So a lot of the out-of-pocket costs that patients complained to us about were actually raised in an outpatient setting. And obstetrics is the big one there, where the majority of care for a healthy mum occurs in an outpatient setting. And funds are actually not allowed to co-fund that with the MBS. But the MBS, as it not only is the rates of payment sometimes very low for the services provided, but it's gone up and down over the years as the government has made changes to the safety net. And the impact on patients hasn't really been front of mind as much as it should have been through that process. So look, the issues are complex. We keep a very close eye on it. Sometimes what we see is providers making up an income if there's been an interruption, like during the pandemic, and we think that those effects are short term. But other times we have seen, in particular treatment groups, an outbreak of very high out-of-pocket costs which haven't been justified, and then we really need to work with the Department of Health and the clinicians concerned to work out what's going on there. Yeah. At very least, we think patients need to be fully informed about why they're paying an out-of-pocket cost in advance and what they're paying for and the likelihood that it's going to give them the benefit they expect. And I think that is really the least that we can do for our members.
You were saying you're keeping an eye on obstetrics. Are there any other specialties that are particularly heinous in this regard?
We're working very hard with particular clinician groups to deliver certain common services at the lowest possible out-of-pocket cost. And I think you can see that with some of the models of care that are being funded now in orthopaedics, where for some patients we're able to offer, or some funds are able to offer, a short stay, low out-of-pocket cost joint replacement service. It's not suitable for everybody. Obviously, some people with multiple comorbidities who are chronically ill will not be able to access that safely. Yeah. But for a number of patients, they are wanting and needing that choice. These are people that don't have other conditions, they don't identify as sick, and they just want to get, you know, they want the lowest cost and they just want to get back to doing whatever they were doing before, whether it's working, raising grandchildren and so forth. For that group, there's really no point in charging them a fortune so they never come back. The idea is that, you know, you give them a, you know, an affordable access to a service that is entirely what they need at their time of life, and then as they get older, you know, they'll access they may need to access other things. Yeah. But if you just clean them out in the first go, then they're going to end up on the, in the public system for the next set of treatments, and that both, you know, unfair and counterproductive. By offering patients that choice based on that life stage, we are able actually to limit out-of-pocket costs for some conditions. Some conditions persistently attract high out-of-pocket costs, and I think things like bariatric surgery fall into that area. Also, in some areas where the scope of work of the clinician is changing, like cardiothoracic surgery, where, you know, the interventional cardiologists are taking on more and more of the work because of technology changes. Consequence, we've seen some of the out-of-pockets creep up there. There's no easy solution to those things. I mean, bariatric surgery is... it's not really insurance what we're providing. It's more, you know, a source of funding, of which there are multiple, like, you know, self-pay and superannuation and so forth. The public sector doesn't really touch it. Yep. These things are not easy. We have the, you know, we need to work with the Commonwealth and the MBS, where there are very significant funding constraints, and we need to work with clinicians about trying to, firstly, to maximise proper informed financial and clinical consent in these cases, but also to ensure that, you know, when there is a need to charge an out-of-pocket, that it's manageable for the patient groups they're trying to serve.
I wanted to talk to you about managed care, because we did a little bit on the honeysuckle situation. What is the PHA's attitude towards that kind of managed care model?
We don't believe that managed care is in US style managed care is even possible in Australia, and we've made this case very strongly to the ACCC and other regulators, which they seem to accept. And the reason is that because of the Medicare system, and that our, and that private health is attached to the Medicare benefit schedule, the health funds don't get to say whether a procedure is provided or not, or, you know, how much a doctor charges for that. In our system, that is completely up to the medical specialist concerned. We have no employee, employer, or master-servant relationship with doctors at all. And any change to clinical practice that we might support needs to be negotiated with them with a lot of evidence from third parties and the research community that it's appropriate. So, like, the types of things that doctors that are concerned about managed care talk to us about are not even possible in Australia. Yeah. So I think we need to put that concern to one side and get to the bottom of what doctors are worried about in cases where they actually raise this issue. And I think honeysuckle's a case in point, but I sat through a number of meetings with concerned clinicians about honeysuckle. And I think the main concern was a relationship which honeysuckle has with Cigna Healthcare in the US to share data. Now, this is not something that should really threaten Australian doctors at all, because it doesn't change the fundamental structure of the system. It's just data, the same way that I might get data from the Australian Commission for Quality and Safety in Healthcare and share it with clinicians, which is something that we do a lot of the time if we're trying to influence practice in, you know, to ensure that it's up to date. This is not something that I think clinicians should really, in many ways, welcome an extra source of information, but see it for what it is. It's data, and it can be added to the raft of data and analytics that we have available to us to make sure that, you know, our patient care is kept up to date in terms of quality, affordability, and access. But there's honeysuckle has no way of forcing doctors to do anything. If doctors, you know, don't want to contract with honeysuckle, or if they don't want to be involved in a hospital that contracts with honeysuckle, then it's their choice. We're quite happy for clinician-driven healthcare to remain the case in Australia. You know, I don't think bureaucrats should be choosing whether they work in the Department of Health or for a fund or for DVA or whatever. The bureaucrats fundamentally shouldn't be choosing what patient care somebody has. Yeah.
I'm chatting today with Dr. Rachel David, CEO of Private Healthcare Australia. This podcast accompanies a news article published by Insight Plus, the full link to which you will find in the show notes to this podcast. If you're enjoying this chat, you can find our back catalogue of episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts, where they are all free to access. To get notified about upcoming episodes, you can subscribe to our feed at your favourite podcast platform. Just search for Medical Journal of Australia and push the magic button. Back to our chat. So we've been doing a series in the run-up to the election. You know, 1 week we were trying to fix general practice. Next week we're trying to fix public health, and now we're trying to fix private health. When I was talking with Claire Jackson about general practice, she suggested that it was time private health insurance covered general practice consultations. Is that a practical suggestion?
It is something that we need to work through with whoever the new minister is. I think there are ways in which health funds could affordably and equitably be involved in general practice, but I think if it was against the MBS payments for outpatient services, that would be both inflationary and very inequitable, because it would not be possible for people without health insurance they'd be trying to access a different level of service. And we've already got that problem with some of the bulk billing clinics versus some of the flasher general practices that are in nice areas, which do charge a co-payment, but which offer a much fuller service. You know, so we've already got a kind of two-tier system evolving just through the MBS and the low value that's put on general practice services, and I wouldn't want to make that any worse than it is now. But general practices can be funded in other ways, and we're already seeing funds contribute to general practice in some regional areas where there's no other choice. In places like the Hunter, the Latrobe Valley and Northern Tasmania, we've got funds that are already funding, for example, the operating costs of a general practice. There is in Northern Tasmania, there's GP urgent care, which the health fund is involved in as well, the local health fund. So there's no reason why we can't consider a practice payment structure for particular services that could be operated at scale outside these regions. Some of the areas that I think we could absolutely should look at, obviously prevention, then and the GP's involvement in primary prevention, GP obstetric shared care, pain management for chronic pain, which, you know, so that people can avoid getting on the bandwagon of multiple medical investigations and procedures that lead nowhere, and mental health, and then the treatment of addictions in primary care, where, you know, there's a huge limit, drug and alcohol detox in the public sector.
Yeah.
Even the private sector, and probably not enough consideration is given to whether a percentage of those patients can be treated in the community by a GP.
The private health sector was kind of created to help take some of the load off the public health sector.
Yeah.
Could that be done more, particularly in the wake of COVID? For example, public hospitals contracting out elective surgeries to private hospitals, for example. Is that a viable option?
Already, the in terms of elective surgery, the pressure is really taken off the public hospitals. I mean, a public hospital has to be all things to all people. It has to be emergency cases, the elderly and chronically ill, and people with serious chronic conditions. A private hospital can be purely dedicated to surgery, and therefore can be extremely efficient on 24 hours, if that's what the doctors want, to deliver elective surgeries. So there's obviously an efficiency difference for people that are able to pay for private health insurance, which is why the majority of elective surgery takes place in our sector. And it does mean that those patients are not queuing up for precious theatre time in the public sector. But the issue of managing waiting lists by short-term contracts with private hospitals is only ever going to be a temporary solution, waiting lists. It's expensive. Often it's entered into by state governments with a very short-term electoral view about, I've just got to stop this crisis that's happening right now, and they never think about the implications in the long term. I think some of the more sensible health ministers and shadow health ministers in the states are now trying to engage with us about a more long-term strategy, which doesn't undermine the confidence of people already paying for private health insurance in the system, but which is keeping waiting lists manageable and PHI affordable. You know, that may well involve lobbying the Commonwealth in some settings for perhaps some regulatory change to help us manage, you know, some of these things better.
But when I started work, when I was 21, 22, my parents said to me, get private health insurance.
Yep.
It's a long-term investment. Get it. So I've had private health insurance for 36 years. I don't think 22-year-olds now are buying that argument. Is that backed up by data?
I think you're right. There are a lot of pressures on young graduates and young people at the moment. And I think that cost of living, housing affordability, a lot of people start to consider private health insurance now when they're considering having children. And it's almost always women that take it out. Well, the current state of the market is it's 90% women that engage with health funds. It's a very female-oriented product.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I mean, men tend to engage with health funds at the point when they need surgery, when something's broken and they're going into an orthopaedic surgeon and they're ringing up to ask whether, you know, it's cut, you know, they're
yes.
90% of the time it's a female-oriented service. But the pressures on young women, can I afford a baby? You know, will I be able to work through, will I need to work through maternity leave? Will it be covered? Will I have childcare covered? Can I afford a home? I mean, these are enormous pressures. Overwhelmingly, women between 20 and 40 are the ones using mental health services as a result. I had the same experience as you. I was a junior doctor and the union rep came around at night when we were working nights and said, we've got this great product from AHM. It was in those days, based in Wollongong, you should sign up. And I just signed up. I had firsthand experience of what the difference was between private and public. So I just signed up. I made good use of it, particularly with an obstetric crisis that I had with my middle child, who's fortunately fine as a consequence of the quick actions of my private obstetrician. I fully appreciate that this is not an option open for a lot of young people. Now, what we are seeing is that the uptake in that group is driven by women, as I said, and it's driven by the need for mental health cover for conditions that aren't covered for the most part in the public sector. But we need to work hard to keep that level of cover affordable. That means, you know, if we are going to keep downward pressure on premiums, we need to address the issues with medical device cost inflation, address issues around low value care, but also even consider increasing the rebate for that generation. The rebate's been frozen for a number of years. Mm-hmm. We don't believe that means testing should be removed. Means testing's important to keep it affordable. For that generation, I think, for young people starting out and for battlers, to keep the pressure off public hospitals and to keep this group in a situation where they're able to access mental health care, then I think it should be restored to 30%. You know, it's not irrational given what the public sector is asking for now. It gets 6.5. The position of the AMA is that it needs even more to recover for this crisis. So I don't think it's an unreasonable ask for government if in fact that happens.
So wave a magic wand for me, Rachel. What does an ideal private health sector look like in this country and how do we get there?
Well, fair prices, fair and transparent pricing for hospital care and medical technology, an open and transparent relationship with doctors over out-of-pocket costs, keeping them manageable, and a loosening up of regulation so that funds in areas which are appropriate and non-inflationary are able to contribute to outpatient care, and some targeted measures to maintain premium affordability. I mean, that's really my wish list. All of those things the balance in the system and are not, you know, irrational things to ask for.
You know, I was talking to Terry Slevin last week from PHWA and he was talking about the short-termism of politics and how it just hampers long-term planning in health. And we need some brave moves, don't we? We need a couple of politicians to go, right, let's just do this.
And to understand what the impact will be in 10 years' time and really make use of that great intergenerational data set that we get from Treasury, you know, and really understand what is the impact going to be, what's our society going to look like in 10 years' time and 20 years' time, including the impact of issues like climate change, inflation, housing affordability, all of these that we don't operate in isolation. Yeah. In our sector, keeping the community engaged in the process. One thing I'm quite passionate about is that we need to improve the way that the Department of Health or Departments of Health and payers engage with consumers. We have 14 million members and 98% of them do not identify as being sick, but they access the health system regularly. We have departments that think that consultation with the community is to speak with a couple of nominated representatives of disease groups. And yes, their perspective is incredibly important, but you miss the big picture if that's all you do. And it's been good to see a better reliance on things like market research and market research panels, focus testing and quant research and things like the vaccine rollout. We need to do this a lot more often because, you know, quite apart from anything else, some of the disease groups are completely dependent on big pharma and big medtech for their funding. So if that's the only source of information you have, then it's going to be very distorted.
We need to talk more to the healthy insured, don't we?
Yeah, well, exactly. And the healthy people that are accessing Medicare or people that might have a couple of chronic conditions but don't see themselves as being sick or disabled. They go into hospital from time to time for a bit of a checkup and a tune-up, much like they service their car, but they're going back to their normal life. And that is the majority of people.
Thanks, Rachel.
Pleasure.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.